Blog Talk Radio. And welcome, everybody, to the Dragon's Lair on Renegade Broadcasting, the best source for factual information on the planet. And tonight's show will be more about how Christians are retarded and stupidity, as well as how true it is that New Testament Jesus is a Jew, contrary to some people's popular belief. Guns are again on the back burner, along with most of my other subjects that I have lined up. However, I probably will take a break from doing shows like this next week. We'll see. I'm going to kind of play it by ear. It seems as though I keep having to react when it comes to what my next show is, instead of being able to plan out what I'm going to do. But that's okay. So anyway, for the record, today is May 26, 2013, on our screwed up Christian calendar. The sun is at 5 degrees Gemini, and we have an interesting alignment in the sky coming up during the week. After sunset, you'll be able to see Jupiter, Venus, and Mercury in vertical alignment in the sign of Gemini. Just go outside shortly after a sundown, and you'll see all three of them in the sky aligned. Be sure and give a listen to all the other hosts here on Renegade. We have Kyle on Mondays, Dana on Tuesdays, Lou on Wednesdays, Mike on Thursdays, Siegfried on Fridays, Roundtable on Saturdays, and me, of course, on Sundays. I will not monitor the chat. As usual, I may glance at it during the music breaks. Doesn't look like there's a really big crowd here tonight. I know it's Memorial Day weekend. And, of course, I'll be drinking and smoking here where I'm sitting. And maybe some momentary pauses to cough. We have a chat at renegadebroadcasting.com, and I believe we have a live feed tonight. We also have a chat at renegade.chitango.com. RenegadeBroadcasting.chitango.com. And there's the same chat over at AlternativeSocial.com. And I also want to give everybody a reminder about NationalProtectionism.com. Hopefully I shouldn't have to say anything more about that. We all know what that is now. If you don't, go over there and take a look. Again, I don't have a personal website or blog. Probably wouldn't have a life if I did. No calls tonight. I'm really not thinking I'm going to be taking calls too often or at all on any of my shows after some of the ones that I hear. Anyway, if you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com. That is magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to subscribe, just send me an email that says subscribe in the subject line, or just write me. Can't guarantee I can get to all of the emails. And as I've mentioned the past three shows, if you've sent me a request, you will be added on the next mail out. I have not sent anything out probably in about a month now. I will probably mail out the Himmler article that I read on one of my last shows. Cat's in the other room. Looks like she's in a very sedate state of mind at the moment. Let's see here. Let me scroll down on my notes. Again, I want to mention again, I will be covering the perversion of Buddhism by the Abrahamic mind virus real soon, so stay tuned. I'm not sure which show it will be. And again, my shows seem to be here lately reactionary to whatever's happening, but that's okay as long as it works with what we need to get out at the particular moment. So those of you who have written me in the past with your list of requests, you have not been ignored. And also, too, by the way, I want to go ahead and mention that I had brought up the issue of doing a show regarding architecture that will be coming fairly soon. I had to kind of wait till some issues ended so I could have all the information I needed on the topic for that particular aspect of what was going to be part of the show. And I do believe hopefully that has ended, and those plans were accepted by the tyrants down at the city of Houston. So So anyway, I'll explain that when the time comes. So let's see here. Today, again, is Memorial Day weekend, and it's a holiday weekend. It doesn't look like there's a whole lot of people in chat. Probably not a big crowd listening tonight, but most people, I think, listen to my show in the archives anyway. I had mentioned in the chat last night that I did not want any of my future shows on Mamie's shit, okay? No shows of me there. Don't want it. I don't want my information mixed in with all of that truth-tard and patriot-tard crap you got going on over there, as well as shit like, David Duke's Christianity crap. Yeah, some of what he says is fine, but he still pushes the Christian shit, whatever. Okay, I don't want my shit mixed in with that, okay? So you keep my shit separate from the other shit, all right? Okay, I got a question for all you Christians. Why isn't your God never heals any amputees? I mean, you guys are always talking about how God heals. Well, I want you to show me one amputee who has been healed by God and has had a limb restored or whatever is missing. Finger, hand, arm, leg, foot, toe. Good luck. Anyway, I didn't listen to all of the shows last week. I caught some of them in full and some of them in partial, and some of them I just missed. It happens sometimes. I did listen to the first 2 hours of the roundtable last night. And in response to one person who called in and was on the show for a little while, I have this to say. Ray, hell Satan! Okay. Anyway. By the way, if I'm not pissing some people off, then I'm clearly not doing something right. So, or I'm doing something wrong, whatever the case may be. Yeah, I did want to mention there was a topic that was discussed regarding culture. Well, I don't know about all you Yankees or you people out over there on the West Coast or in Canada or Mexico or New Zealand or wherever the hell you are, but where I live, we do have culture here. We have what's called Texas culture. And in the eastern part of the state, we also have what's known as Southern culture. Granted, the Jew virus is infested, but it doesn't mean our culture has disappeared. So I just thought I would mention that. And whenever I get ready to do a show on some things about Texas, that'll be brought up again. There was an issue being discussed over in Alt Social this last few days about Christian art. Well, you know, if you think that's all fine and dandy and you want to look at it, okay, but you know, don't try to convince me that that an image of a Jew on a stick who's been painted or sculpted to look like a white guy has any value. Sorry, you're not going to convince me, okay? And so anyway, and also too, by the way, the cross that was stolen predates Christianity. And if Jesus had existed, he would not have been hung on a cross. It would have been a T. Okay? So let's get that clarified here. Well, what I'm going to do tonight, I've got some web pages I'm going to read. And I didn't script any of it. So in other words, I haven't culled it and put it together and assembled it in a readable fashion. So I'm just going to kind of read from the web page itself. You know, it's Memorial Day weekend. I didn't do a show last week. I'm still feeling a little bit lazy. I also didn't upload any more of my past shows onto my own personal account for a couple of weeks, so it's kind of like I'm getting back in the saddle here tonight after a long hiatus. It was kind of nice to take a break. You know, I did a whole bunch of shows in a row there without interruption, so I guess I was due for a short breather. So anyway, what I want to do here next is I'm going to go ahead and play a song. And we'll get into what I have to get into tonight. So we'll be right back.
Bigger than you, and you are not me. So lean
Okay, I'm back. All right, I've got a whole bunch of web pages up here, multiple tabs, all kind of related to the Nazarene, or the fake Nazarene, as we know he never existed. So, anyway, some of you fools out there seem to buy into this crap, and so this show is, you know, again, it's mainly just talking to you people who really just need to get a clue. But, you know, the ones who already know all this stuff, you know, it's going to be kind of a nice little review. It's nice to go back every once in a while and, you know, look over all the factual information and try to reabsorb it, because it's really hard to, you know, remember all of it. And so so good to get a little reminder every once in a while, you know, nothing like a swift kick in the ass, you know. Something I wanted to mention before I forget. I've got a clip here that I'm going to play off of YouTube, about 27 minutes long, here in just a few minutes after I get past this one webpage, I believe is when I'll do it. It's a lecture that was done in the 80s by a university professor, and it's about early Christianity, and it's he's got a live audience, and but you know, you don't hear any of the audience or anything. It's pretty clear audio, and so I'm going to play the audio to that. Somebody had sent me an email too as well about from regarding another another video that's worth listening to, and I thought maybe I might take some clips from that and play it, but I'm going to go ahead and try and get through some of these web pages here tonight instead of doing that, and probably save that for another show. And I also wanted to mention, too, you know, I mentioned in one of the previous shows recently here that Lou and I had a little project going, and we're making some good progress on it, and I'm not sure whose show it will wind up being on, whether it be mine or Lou's, but nor do I have a date yet, nor do I think he has a date in mind yet, because we're not quite done. But I will say this, it's kind of like, and Lou agrees with me, it's kind of like we're both kind of going back through all of this stuff that we have researched over the years to extract new information out of it, along with any other new information that we come up with, you know, based on the fact that, you know, we both know a little bit more now than we did when we originally went through all of it. And so it's kind of looking at it with more educated or fresh eyes. And so we're going to get to the root of this problem, this mind virus. And we're going to try and help you Christians pull this Jew out of your ass, because you're doing nothing but slowing us down. You know, we're not going to move forward on this road we're on right now without extracting this problem. You know, we can't have a movement based on lies. You know, it's got to be about facts, people. You know, what are you going to do? You're going to convince people that, well, you know, we'll just go out there and win and we'll sort this out later. And somehow they're going to go along with that, especially new people, especially ones who already know Christianity is bullshit. You know, how are you going to get them on board? I've already said that once. You run them off, you scare them away. You know, you aren't doing anything by hanging on to your fucking blanket. Get rid of your blankie, okay? You know, it's time to fucking grow up, all right? You know, I mean, you can't continue this road, all right? You know, and if you refuse to cooperate, then you're not part of the movement, because we are going to become the predominant aspect or the spearhead or whatever phrase you want to use to this movement. And we're going to leave all you fucking shitheads behind. And you can sit there and you can play with your dick and pretend you're accomplishing something when you're not. You're jacking off. Okay? Because we're the ones over here at Renegade who are leading the pack. Whether or not our numbers reflect that or not does not matter, because that's going to change very soon. It's just a matter of time. And so all the work we're doing right now is definitely leading to something. And if any of our enemies are listening out there, well, you know, too bad. That's the way it goes. You know, you've run out of steam. Also, too, I wanted to mention that I think that was really a pretty cool thing that Mike did on Friday night with the music. I've been kind of thinking about doing something like that. I think it'd be really cool if all of the hosts on this network kind of put together a song list and kind of did their own show. You know, music is one of the few things that really unites us as a people. You know, this is something I noticed years ago when I was young. I first started going to concerts, and it's like, man, why can't we get together for other things? You know, it's like, name anything, unless, of course, it's a sports event or some ridiculous bloated church with too many people in it, where this many white people get together at once for anything. Anything. I don't care what it is. You know, name something. You can't. We're all on different pages and every which way you can think of, okay? You know, I mean, yeah, some of us listen to country, some of us listen to rock, whatever. You know, there's all these little divisions and branches, but, you know, all of these branches are still people like us getting together, just in a little smaller section. That's all. So, anyway, that video, by the way, that I'm going to be playing shortly, will be discussing the murder of Hypatia in very graphic detail. And you Christians are going to learn the facts about your past that you just don't know, again, because all you do is read retarded dogma that supports your concepts and ideas, and you just don't get it, okay? And believe me, her murder is just probably one of many. How many witches have been burned at the stake because of you bastards, okay? So, anyway, this first thing I've got here is called The Christian Program and Its Purpose. And this is from Exposing Christianity. SeeTheTruthWebs.com. There's underscore between the words. And see it. C_the_truth.webs.com. This is a quote from the Talmud. God, fucking Hebrew shit I got to read again. Libre David 37. To communicate anything to a goy about our religious relations would be equal to the killing of all Jews. For if the goyim knew what we teach about them, they would kill us openly. With enough research, Christianity and its cohorts can be summed up, revealing its true purpose. Jehovah's Witnesses know of all the pagan origins of the holidays, such as Christmas and Easter. They are deluded as to the Nazarene, as the Nazarene is a stolen concept from some 18-plus crucified pagan gods who hung from a tree, such as Odin. Everything in the Christian program is false, stolen, corrupted, and counterfeit, and there is no spirituality in it. Okay, spirituality, spirit, spirit. Okay, let's start getting these words correct. And let's start speaking, by the way, let's just start speaking properly. I don't want to see the word demonize anymore unless it's in a proper context. You know, demons are the gods of the Gentiles. So let's use the word properly. It's kind of like the word nation. You know, it's been corrupted by the Jew media. You know, every day the weatherman gets up there and says, across the nation. Well, we aren't a nation. Sorry, we haven't been one since 1965. You know, in fairy tales. Okay, we discovered how fairy tales have real meanings. And they were intentionally distorted by pagans to hide truth from the church so the information could be passed down. Just like mystery schools had to go underground to keep from being discovered. So let's keep that in mind. And you know, even a fable has some sort of a story behind it that you can gain something from it. You know, I don't want to be too specific on the meaning of a fable. However, it tends to get used in the context of something that's being false. Well, maybe it's not a fairy tale. Maybe it is false. Maybe not. But the point being is it doesn't have to be negative. So anyway, the entire purpose of Christianity is to prepare Gentiles to be slavishly obedient and worshiping of their Jewish masters in a new world order, where the Jews will have total and complete control unless people wake up and this is stopped. Okay, that's a key point. Well, that's what we intend to try to do. Now, the other issue here is that it pacifies you. It turns you into cattle, literally and figuratively. Go back and listen to my shows where I discussed how a people who have a lack of spiritual practices degenerate metagenically. Okay? Genetics is really metagenics. So, and speaking of past shows, I know I keep interrupting myself here. If you haven't, go back and listen to my past shows. You know, don't just listen to one and get all confused and then make ridiculous comments when you call into our show about things that you probably don't know about. Then again, maybe you do, but you just don't like it. Well, tough. So anyway, as can be seen from the articles on this website, the pantheon of Gentile pagan gods was replaced with fictitious Jewish archetypes with the program of Christianity. Along with this, the Jews achieved a special status they did not deserve, being the chosen of God. All of this is subliminal in that it creates the mindset of slavish, self-sacrificing, servile mentality in its victims that readily accepts the Jews to be in charge. The fictitious Jewish archetype, such as the Nazarene, and by the way, Nazareth did not exist at the time that supposedly this fictitious individual lived. The fictitious Jewish archetype, such as the Nazarene, creates a powerful subconscious association with what is known as the God part of the brain, and acts to transfer the mindset of worship to the Jews who intend upon ruling the world. Now, before I go any further, I'm going to interrupt myself again. What you're doing is you're worshiping a thought form, and I've said this before, and I'm not going to get to it this show, but that's an occult term. There's also things similar like a tulpa or a golem, though they're related but not necessarily the same. But what you're doing is when you pray to this Jehovah character, you're sending energy into a thought form that's been created by Jewish sorcerers that they take advantage of and use on you and against you in ways that you can never imagine. They're adepts in the black magic of the right-hand path. Okay, where was I at here? Worship the Jews who intend, okay, the fictitious Jewish archetype serves that, such as the Nazarene, create a powerful subconscious association with what is known as the God part of the brain and act to transfer this mindset of worship to the Jews who intend upon ruling the world. There is nothing at all spiritual about Christianity. Absolutely nothing. Period. In the conversation. Name any spirit in Christianity you can talk to. You can't even talk to a dead ancestor. Okay? Much less a demon. The Bible is nothing more than a fictitious history of the Jews, an intense blasphemy against the Gentile gods and our true creator God, which means enemy in Hebrew, or adversary. We prove all of this on this website. Here's a quote from the Jewish Talmud. Simeon Hadarson, 56D, quote, "When the Messiah comes, every Jew will have 2,800 slaves," close quote. See? In addition to the subliminal workings, Gentiles are severely threatened with delving into the occult in order to remove all powers of the mind and soul and to keep these powers within the circle of ruling Jewish masters for total abuse and exploitation of the Gentiles. Because sexual orgasm is the doorway to the power and advancement of the soul, the Christian doctrines have always worked relentlessly to suppress it. Christianity drums into its victims' minds that they are nothing more than property. You're born committing sin just by existing. Their minds, souls, and bodies all belong to Jehovah, which in reality is the top ruling Jews who are the masters of occult power. Another quote from the Talmud. Nidrash Talpioth, 225, Jehovah created the non-Jew in human form so that the Jew would not have to be served by beast. The non-Jew is consequently an animal in human form and condemned to serve the Jew day and night. Here's another one. Seph, S-E-P-H, period. Quote, God has given the Jews power over the possessions and blood of all nations, close quote. The degeneration of women in these programs is a sick, twisted, and perverted attempt, again, subliminal, like the suppression of human sexuality, to deprive Gentiles of occult power. This has its origins in the Far Eastern teachings of Shakti, which represent the female, or the subconscious and the Kundalini power aspect of the human soul. The male aspect is the left-brained logical side. Both must work together to achieve material results, which is the purpose of yoga. By suppressing the female side of the brain, one's powers of the mind and soul are completely dormant and inaccessible. There's other forms of divination have been strictly suppressed as well in attempts to deprive Gentiles from communicating with our gods, who have been shamefully and hideously blasphemed and labeled as evil. Our gods have been the victims of Jewish horror and gore Hollywood flicks and other degenerating and insulting themes, where Gentiles are fooled into mocking, cursing, and fearing them while working for their own damnation and paying out the ass for it, not only to the tune of trillions and trillions of dollars, but also with psychic energy. The Jews have had a long history of deluding the Gentiles into paying for their own damnation and ruin. The war in Iraq is a blatant example, where thousands of young American men and women have died or are permanently disabled, all for Israel. Gentiles need badly to wake up. Okay, I'm going to kill that webpage. Let me go back to the studio here. And let me scroll to find where that piece is. That little lecture, 27-minute lecture. Okay, I think I went too far here. Give me just one sec. And all right, here we go. Early Christianity, 27 minutes, 36 seconds. Don't go to the bathroom. You need to hear this, okay? And again, it's going to discuss Hypatia. All right, back shortly.
Funding for this program is provided by Annenberg CPB to advance excellent teaching.
The Roman Empire withstood war and the madness of its rulers until the stamp of Greco-Roman culture was left on Europe and on the Mediterranean world. Among those affected were the Jews, and through Jews, a new heresy spread that would transform the West. Early Christianity, this time on the Western Tradition.
UCLA Professor Eugen Weber's continuing journey through the history of Western civilization.
The story of the Roman Empire can be simply told. The two centuries that opened with the Emperor Augustus were a time of peace and prosperity. There were crazy emperors and murderous emperors and murdered emperors, but the empire marched on, the Mediterranean was full of ships, the roads were safe, the borders were well guarded. Greco-Roman civilization seemed so stable, in fact, that it was taken as the ultimate structure of the world. History was no longer a process, but the record of how civilization got to be so stable and perfect. And politics were not about how things should go, but how things should be kept the way they were. The third century, however, was a time of troubles, of war, of civil war, until the reign of Diocletian from 284 to 305, which was a period of reorganization and reconstruction. For nearly another century, there was relative peace, but after that, everything went to pieces. The economy cracked, the provinces were invaded by barbarians, Rome itself was sacked, and in 476, Romulus Augustulus retired to the country, the last emperor to rule from Rome over the western part of the empire. And so the end came just about 5 centuries after the Battle of Actium and the beginning of the Peace of Augustus.
It was a remarkable run. As Edward Gibbon, the 18th century historian, wrote, instead of inquiring why the Roman Empire was destroyed, we should rather be surprised that it subsisted so long. The real turning point came not in the 5th century, but way back in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, when Rome realized that she was mortal, and when the calm confidence of an earlier age lapsed into something more anxious, more uneasy, increasingly decadent. You can chart the change in the portraits of the emperors. This is a bust of Trajan, who ruled from 98 to 117 and who was one of the best emperors Rome ever had. He seems to have grown old with a sense of humor and a certain skepticism. 50 years later, however, emperors, just like their subjects, looked sad or worse. This is a portrait of Marcus Aurelius, a Stoic who ruled from 161 to 180. He was an excellent emperor, but one who seemed to carry the weight of the world on his shoulders. From that time on, the emperors range from sad to worried, as in this portrait of Decius, to brutish, like the emperor Caracalla, or to simply insane, like the young Commodus, son and successor of Marcus Aurelius, who rejected the rationalism of the Stoics and invoked the protection of every Oriental deity in the book. Cybele, the great mother from Asia Minor, Mithras from Persia, Isis from Egypt, and any other god who promised salvation or immortality.
So in the course of one century, the Romans shifted from confidence and stability to anxious uncertainty. And their view of the world shifted as well, especially in religion and philosophy. Back in the 2nd century BC, when Rome first became open to Greek ideas, the philosophy that became popular was Stoicism. You remember that for the Stoics, the basis of morality was conformity with nature, not only one's truly human nature, but also that of the divine world order. The wise man perceived true nature and true order and conformed to them. The Romans adapted this to their needs by emphasizing self-mastery, temperance, courage, dedication. But they also learned the universal humanitarian ideas of Stoicism, and their limited original notion of virtù as manliness in the service of the state. This was enlarged and enriched. The old parochial morality was broadened into a new humanism.
Men like Cicero try to apply humanism to the practical problems of political and social life. Born in 106 BC, Cicero, shown here, was a Roman orator, statesman, and philosopher until his outspokenness against Mark Antony and Octavian got him killed. It was in the name of a more humane philosophy that the Stoic Seneca became the tutor and then the counselor of the young emperor Nero, until Nero accused him of conspiracy and ordered him to take his own life. And it was Stoic philosophy that helped justify a princeps like Augustus, a first citizen, that is, who would be the wise and virtuous protector of the state. The Stoics had transformed the Platonic notion of a philosopher king into the idea that all men were equal in essence, but not in ability or virtue. There were a few superior souls, like Augustus, who had pressed through to lighter knowledge, and these alone could conceive and carry out what was good. And many of the reforms of Augustus reflected this conception of the exceptional man, a man with a mission who set out to re-establish and secure the balance and harmony of the world that were threatened by excess and corruption. Hence Augustus's efforts to restore the old moral virtues, to reaffirm traditional marriage, to re-establish old religious practices and the religious rituals of old Rome. This incidentally is a shrine in a sacred landscape, to train and to hone a ruling elite based on Greco-Roman humanism, whose values would still be taught in school in the 19th and 20th centuries. But this Augustan restoration, which lasted a long time, ultimately proved precarious because it depended on exceptional individuals to handle an immense and overwhelming task, the governing of an empire. And these outstanding individuals were not always available. The restoration was also shaky because the culture that was offered, or rather imposed upon, the lower classes by Augustus, this clashed with a brutishness and irrationality that was common among the lower classes. And rationality sat uneasily on the upper classes as well, so when hard times came, it proved a veneer easy to discard. Augustus tried to introduce an ascetic, elitist philosophy good for the brightest and best. These men were told that public service was their duty and that power had to be exercised only to good ends and then with moderation. But the religious rituals were too businesslike, too cool for hot periods, and the philosophy was too demanding for normal people. So when security collapsed and the economy broke down, danger and death were more on their minds and in their art. Stoicism was replaced by new ideas and new aspirations. What most people wanted as times grew hard was something more personal, more accessible, and they expressed this by saying that they wanted salus, a word which originally meant simply physical health, but which came to mean the health of the soul, that is, salvation. Stoic humanism might be good for a philosopher like Seneca, but the psychotic Emperor Nero did not want to be told what to do, and Seneca's stoicism came in handy when Nero asked him to commit suicide. A century later, stoicism led Marcus Aurelius to write his Meditations, but his son and successor Commodus was a crazy lout, less interested in inner fortitude than in magic salvation. By that time, Roman culture was running hard just to stand still. Respectable citizens were trying to plumb the great unknown by way of seances like this one. Emperors prayed for miracles to get them out of tight spots. And ordinary people relied on religious charms, astrologers and soothsayers, and lots of amulets.
If you're caught in an air raid and the bombs are falling, you know that virtue or wisdom or strength make no difference, and you pray for divine intervention. That's what happened as the second century slipped into the third and the fourth. in politics, in thought, in the arts, the realism and naturalism and the sense of perspective that were part of a rational attitude to nature and the world, these gave way. The more disorder grew, the less relevant rationality seemed. The more the empire cracked, the less self-discipline and self-reliance seemed to work. The more doctrines of salvation offered a promise of escape, which brings me to Christianity. There are three things we have to bear in mind when we look at early Christianity. First, the cultural context of a Hellenistic world all around it. Second, the Jewish sources of the new creed and the Jewish influences on it. And third, the changes in the contemporary world between the first century when Christianity was born and the fourth century when it was recognized by the Roman state. In other words, the ways in which the world affected Christianity and the ways in which Christianity affected the world.
If we begin by looking at the dominant Hellenistic culture of the ancient world, we find that it had been deeply infiltrated by Orientalism, especially as regards religion. This, for example, is a Roman figure clad in Egyptian clothes. And this is a scene from one of the mystery religions, or from a Gnostic cult claiming to offer access to gnosis, or knowledge of spiritual mysteries. These cults were most popular among women and among the lower classes for whom they had been greatly simplified and vulgarized. They were not new, but their importance in the Hellenistic Greco-Roman world was new. Speaking in general terms, we might describe that world as skeptical, tolerant, and materialistic. This, for example, is a pillow merchant doing business in the marketplace. But it was above all, perhaps, a cosmopolitan world in which, under Roman rule, tribes and races intermingled within the same empire. In the midst of this, only the Jews really kept their identity and their uncompromising Semitic outlook. The word Semitic, remember, refers back to the Semites, a people who moved from the Arabian desert into Mesopotamia more than 2,000 years before Christ. The Hebrews were Semites, and so were the people we now call Arabs. The Jews especially were children of an idea, the idea of Jehovah, a God of supreme universal significance and power, but with whom they had a particular, unique, and exclusive relationship. It was this idea that kept them alive as a people through years of trial and tribulation, alive and also jealously aloof from other religious influences in the world around them. Although Hellenistic influences affected the Jews as they affected everybody else, they affected them first in a contrary fashion, by making them resist assimilation, by stirring their nationalism, and by forcing them to reconsider and reform their religious attitudes and their ethics. In the year 175 before Christ, Antiochus IV, who ruled Syria and Palestine, started a campaign designed to unify his realm by wiping out competing religions and traditions. And so he prohibited circumcision and dietary laws, which were central to Judaism. The Jews, of course, refused to give up their traditions. They refused to worship Antiochus IV as a god, to subordinate their religion to the state. The friction got worse until it finally erupted in the bloody Maccabean Revolt of 164 BC. That was so bloody and murderous that even today the French slang for corpse is macabre. These are coins struck by the new Maccabean rulers. As often happens, the results of the revolt went well beyond the practical issues that set it off. And in this case, the chief result was mainly that in resistance, the Jewish religion survived as a distinct and very self-conscious belief.
If Antiochus had succeeded, if Judaism as such had died out, neither Christianity nor Mohammedanism in the form they actually took would have existed. But as it happened, the persecutions and the fighting produced a sort of revival of Judaism, partly as a nationalistic manifestation, partly as a search for consolation. War was hell, life was hell, and so, just to make up for it, the Jews started to think of heaven. They took over ideas of immortality from the Gnostics, and they did this partly to encourage themselves and their friends not to bow to Antiochus and to the Syrian gods. Look at it this way. If you had to choose between sticking to Jehovah and being burnt, or worshipping a barbarian god like Baal and staying alive, you could take comfort and fortitude from the fact that if you were burnt, you would be rewarded afterwards in eternity, which is a long time. On the other hand, if you broke your compact with Jehovah, life was short, and you would be very sorry afterwards.
The Hellenistic influence, which was rejected by the Jews when he tried a frontal attack, was, however, going to affect Jewish thought in more subtle ways through the ethical developments of Pharisaic philosophy. The Pharisees were a religious sect given to piety, earnest prayer, strict observance of Jewish law, but also to interpreting the law of Moses in the context of changing situations. Jewish observance in general centered increasingly on reading the law and the scriptures in the synagogue, discussing them, interpreting them. This was a habit which led people to think for themselves and to listen to others around them who were developing notions to be found less in the scriptures than in current thought. Belief in an immortal soul, in angelic spirits, in personal resurrection, in free will reconciled with predestination.
So with one ear to Hellenistic culture and another to their inner voice, the Pharisees were going to evolve most of the socially significant ideas which have since come down to us in the New Testament. The Sermon on the Mount is a perfect reflection of early Pharisaic doctrine. For those of you who know it, here is a passage that may sound familiar. Love ye one another from the heart, and if a man sin against thee, speak peaceably to him, and in thy soul hold no guile. And if he repent and confess, forgive him. But if he deny it, do not get into a passion with him, lest catching the poison with thee, he take to swearing, and so sin doubly. And if he be shameless and persist in wrongdoing, even so forgive him from the heart, and leave to God the avenging.
This passage was written by Jews over a century before the birth of Christ. It comes from the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs, which was written between 109 and 107 BC, and which later proved extremely popular with St. Paul, and was probably known to Christ as well. Now, obviously, we cannot understand Christianity unless we realize that it was the product of this long development and interaction of thought and religion within and upon the Jewish people. Jesus, after all, was a Jew and probably a rabbi who followed Jewish law. And Christianity was first preached by Jews to Jews as a sort of reformed Judaism. Jesus won a considerable following among Jews, especially among the poor, until his success provoked the hostility of the Jewish establishment, which did not find it difficult to convince the Roman governor that Jesus was a dangerous radical. So the Romans put him to death in Jerusalem, probably in 30 AD. But it's important to realize that from the first, Christianity claimed to be not a break from, but the continuation and the fulfillment of the great history of the Old Testament, which promised a Messiah, a Redeemer, who would make Israel and the Jewish people triumph over their enemies.
The Christians inherited a lot of things from the Jews, including the Semitic sense of world worthlessness and the conflict between body and spirit. And they took over, too, the typically Jewish vision of a blinding, all-powerful God above, and the abject condition of man below, with his overwhelming sense of sin and a passion for salvation. But this salvation could not come from anything man could do, as the rationalist Greeks might have argued, but only from God, or, as St. Paul later put it, from faith in God, which in Christian terms is simply faith in the reality and value of Christ's sacrifice. However, there is one thing to remember about all this. At the beginning, in order to be a Christian, you had to be a Jew. There was no thought of separateness in Christian communities, which were merely reformed religious groups within a Jewish community. We shall see how this changed and why in our next program.
Okay, I actually did not upload the right one. However, that was one that I wanted to play at another point. So it was good that we went ahead and heard that. And however, you can still hear the bias in there referring to Europeans as barbarians. Essentially, they were considered to be, if you were uncivilized, you were a barbarian. And how did they define civilized? Well, they defined civilized as Christian. So there were other various things in there that I'm sure everybody was able to get something out of. What I'm doing right now is I'm downloading the proper video that I wanted to play on my other computer while I'm talking, and hopefully during the course of this show I will get this converted to MP3, and maybe I can get this uploaded while I'm doing the rest of the show, and we'll be able to hear the murder of Hypatia. So anyway, in the meantime, while this is happening on my other computer, I will go ahead and proceed with the topic of the Nazarene. This is also from the same website. It's called The Nazarene, the Worst Sinner of Them All. Christians believe the Nazarene to be perfect, a peaceful, loving, healing, and understanding being. Most are too lazy to read the facts. The Bible may be the most purchased book, but it is the least read. The Nazarene was slothful, indolent, and lazy. He never worked like everybody else. He freeloaded and lived off the work and labors of others. He was rude and inappreciative guest who often insulted his host. He stole and ordered others to do so. He condoned and advocated murder. He is one of the worst hypocrites who ever existed. Let's take a look at some of this here. The seven deadly sins, pride. The Nazarene was very arrogant, selfish, and a conceited individual. His overwhelming sense of negative pride and self-exaltation was seen in many of the scriptures. He was arrogant enough to insult his host and leave her with the burden of work while he hogged all of the attention, indicating an extreme sense of self-importance. So if you look at Luke chapter 10, verses 38 through 42, and read that. I'm not going to read that for you. That's just one example. You can look it up. Anyone who does not love him more than their own parents is not worthy of him. What happened to honor thy father and mother? Here the Nazarene is placing himself above the family members of his followers, again indicating pride and extreme arrogance. Matthew chapter 10, verse 37. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. This is also the sin of envy. He is so jealous of anyone who might share their love for another. The pleasure of being massaged with expensive ointment was more important than selling the ointment and giving the money to the poor. Mark 14, 3 through 7. The Nazarene calls other human beings dogs and swine, indicating they are way beneath him. And you can find that in Matthew chapter 7, verse 6. He stated he was greater than Jonas and Solomon. And you can find that in Matthew chapter 12, verses 41 through 42. Now, envy. The Nazarene was so envious of any devotion or affection shown for anyone other than himself, even close family members, he demanded that his disciples leave their families behind. Luke 9, 59 through 62. And I'm going to read this one. And he said unto another, follow me. But he said, Lord, suffer me first to go and bury my father. Jesus said unto him, let the dead bury their dead, but go thou and preach the kingdom of God. And another also said, Lord, I will follow thee, but let me first go bid them farewell, which are at home at my house. And Jesus said unto him, no man having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. What an asshole. There are many more scriptures that blatantly expose the envious resentment character of the Nazarene. These are indicated in this article. Here's one on wrath. Because an excessive sense of pride, exaggerated self-importance and arrogance, and an overwhelming belief of being first and being entitled, the Nazarene was often subject to the sin of wrath. Matthew 11, 20 through 24. Matthew chapter 11, 20 through 24. The Nazarene is forever condemning, insulting, and threatening others. Matthew 23:23, ye serpents, ye generation of vipers, how can ye escape the damnation of hell? Mark 3:5, and when he looked around about on them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts, he said unto the man, stretch forth thine hand. John 2:15, and when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep and the oxen, and poured out the changers' money and overthrew the temples. In the above verse, the Nazarene is condemning moneymakers in the temple and greed, in the temple with greed, but by his actions and demands, the Nazarene is the greediest of them all. The Nazarene makes it plain he comes to bring war on earth and conflict, hatred and enmity among family members, breaking up the family unit and home. And I'm going to read these too. Matthew 10, verses 34 through 36. Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes shall be they of his own household. Nice guy. He showed impatience and upset by the presence of a father whose child could not speak, that petitioned him for help. his personal time and energy were more important than spending a few seconds to help a small child who was handicapped. He also insulted his disciples and those around him who he spoke to in reply to the asking for help. Mark 9:19. O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me. Greed. The Nazarene's distaste for labor was highly impractical because he lived off the charity of others. There were times when the charity couldn't satisfy his needs, so he stole. On the Sabbath, he and his disciples helped themselves to a farmer's corn. When asked why he violated the law by eating on the Sabbath, he justified stealing by calling himself Lord of the Sabbath. Luke 6:1-5. And it came to pass on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the cornfields, and his disciples plucked through the ears of corn and did eat, rubbing them in their hands. And certain of the Pharisees said unto them, Why do ye that which is not lawful to do on the Sabbath days? Why do ye that which is not lawful to do on the Sabbath days? And Jesus answered them, saying, Have ye not read so much as this, what David did when himself was hungered, and they which were with him, how he went into the house of God and did take and eat the shewbread, and gave also to them that were with him, which is not lawful to eat but for the priest alone? And he said unto them, that the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. Arrogant prick. The Nazarene's sloth and greed often led to more theft. He sent two disciples to steal an ass and a colt. He had no consideration as to whether taking the animals for himself would place any hardship upon whom he stole them from. Here, in addition to the act of stealing, the Nazarene does not have the nerve to go and steal these animals himself. He orders others to do so. Luke 19:29-35. And it came to pass when he was come nigh to the Bethphage in Bethany, at the mount called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying, Go ye into the village over against you, in the which at your entering ye shall find a colt tied, whereon yet never man sat, loose him and bring him hither. And if any man ask you, Why do ye loose him? Thus shall ye say unto him, Because the Lord hath need of him. And they that were sent went their way and found even as he had said unto them. And as they were loosing the colt, the owner therefore said unto them, Why loose ye the colt? And they said, The Lord hath need of him. And they brought him to Jesus, and they cast their garments upon the colt, and they set Jesus thereon. God damn, this guy's an asshole. Do you Christians ever read anything in your Bible? I mean, you know, how blatant is it? You know, I mean, it's right there. All you got to do is open the damn thing. You know, instead you listen to some preacher who gets up there and goes through this thing and says, Well, this sounds good. Well, this sounds good, but I'm going to ignore this part of it right here. And, by the way, that part, we're not going to talk about that either. And we'll just keep them all with, the carrot on the stick in front of them there. So, anyway, sloth. The Nazarene has always been known for his hatred of physical labor. The Nazarene also hated washing and bathing. Here the Nazarene encourages not washing. Matthew 15:1-20. Then came to Jesus scribes and Pharisees, which were of Jerusalem, saying, Why do thy disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they wash not their hands when they eat bread. For out of their heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man, but to eat with unwashed hands defileth not a man. Mark 7:1-9. Then came together unto him the Pharisees and certain of the scribes which came from Jerusalem. And when they saw some of the disciples eat bread with defiled, that is to say, with unwashed hands, they found fault. For the Pharisees and all the Jews, except they wash their hands oft, eat not, holding the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the market, except they wash, they eat not. And many others many other things there be, which they have received to hold, as the washing of cups, pots, and brazen vessels, and of tables. And the Pharisees and scribes asked him, Why walk not thy disciples according to the tradition of the elders, but eat bread with unwashing hands? He answered and said unto them, Well hath Esaias prophesied of you hypocrites, as it is written, This people honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. Howbeit in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. For laying aside the commandment of God, ye hold the tradition of men, as the washing of pots and cups, and many other such like things ye do. And he said unto them, Full well, ye reject the commandment of God, that ye may keep your own tradition. So, God's tradition is sloth. Let me light this. It went out. I'm going to play a long song here in a minute while I work on this other file, because I really want everybody to hear it, and I hope I've got the right one, by the way. Anyway, also, the stretch in the desert speaks for itself. Read Matthew 4, verses 1 and 2. Gluttony. Gluttony is an inordinate desire to consume more than which one requires. Although the Nazarene preached abstinence, he did not intend this for himself. He gets defensive about complaints directed at him and his followers, who are always seen eating and drinking. Luke 5, 33-34. And they said unto him, Why do the disciples of John fast often and make prayers, and likewise the disciples of the Pharisees, but thine eat and drink? And he said unto them, Can ye make the children of the bride chamber fast while the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom shall be taken away from them, and then shall they fast in those days. He was known as a glutton and a drunkard. Luke 7:34. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and ye say, Behold, a gluttonous man, and a winebibber, a friend of publicans and sinners. The Nazarene was wrathful when his sources for free meals were not readily available. Once he cursed a fig tree for not having any fruit. The tree died. Mark 11:12-14 and 20-22. And on the morrow, when they were come from Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing a fig tree afar off having leaves, he came, if haply he might find anything thereon. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for the time of figs was not yet. And Jesus answered and said unto it, No man eat fruit of thee hereafter forever. And his disciples heard it. And in the morning, as they passed by, they saw the fig tree dried up from the roots. And Peter, calling to remembrance, saith unto him, Master, behold, the fig tree which thou cursest is withered away. And Jesus answering saith unto them, Have faith in God. Okay. Lust. Lust is an inordinate craving for the pleasures of the body. Well, can be any sorts of things, but usually that's the reference is the body. The Nazarene preached celibacy for his followers, but being the hypocrite that he is, he did not apply these teachings to himself. Both men and women put out sexual favors for him, as did others in the way of food, shelter, and other needs. Luke 8:1-3, And it came to pass afterward that he went through every city and village, preaching and shewing the glad tidings of the kingdom of God, and the 12 were with him. And certain women, which had been healed of evil spirits and infirmities, Mary called Magdalene, out of whom went 7 devils, and Jonah the wife of Chuza, Herod's steward, and Susanna, and many others, which ministered unto him of their substance. Okay. And by the way, there are deleted passages in the Gospel of Mark. The Nazarene had intercourse with one of his disciples while the others slept in the garden before his crucifixion. The Nazarene advocated and encouraged murder for selfish reasons. Luke 19-27. But those mine enemies, which would not that I should reign over them, bring hither and slay them before me. The Nazarene not only advocated slavery, but encouraged and condoned the abuse of slaves. Luke 12:47. And that servant which knew his Lord's will and prepared not himself, neither did according to his will, shall be eaten with many stripes. In addition to the Sermon on the Mount, which, by the way, is a ripoff of Abrahamic Buddhism, which is polluted Buddhism, in addition to the Sermon on the Mount being anti-life and against nature or artificial, the Nazarene's actions speak much louder than his words and reveal his true nature and that of a big hypocrite. Matthew 5, and seeing the multitudes, he went up into the mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The Nazarene was anything but poor in spirit. He was arrogant, self-righteous, and always put his own needs and desires before that of others. Luke 10:38-42 and Matthew 10:37. Look them up. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Matthew 8:21-22. And another of his disciples said unto him, Lord, suffer me first to go and bury my father. But Jesus said unto him, Follow me, and let the dead bury their dead. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Meek means humble. Read the above paragraph of scriptures that was just read, revealing the Nazarene's pride and arrogance. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. The Nazarene openly advocated and encouraged chaos and lawlessness. These unethical, suicidal, anti-life teachings have worked to undermine and destroy legal systems, resulting in the punishment of the victim, while criminals were rewarded and encouraged in their behavior. The end result is the collapse of civilization. Any species that fails to defend itself will end up extinct. If the human body ignored the germs, bacteria, and viruses that invaded it, nearly all people would be dead in less than a day. These teachings are anti-life and designed to destroy human lives. Matthew 5, verses 38-44. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law, and take away the coat, let him have the cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Ye have heard that it hath been said, Thou shalt love thy neighbor, and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Lovely. Yeah, I think I'll let my enemies just walk all over me. Better yet, it'd be just easier to just kiss their ass and just hand them everything. You know, kind of like what you do for the church when they want some money from you or taxes. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. The Nazarene was anything but merciful. He is forever condemning, threatening, and damning people. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. The Nazarene was anything but pure of heart. He lied. John 5:31. If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. The Nazarene told his disciples they would not die before his second coming. Matthew 16:28. Verily I say unto you, there be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Revelation 3:11. Behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which thou hast, that no man take thy crown. He stole. Luke 19:29-35. Luke 6:1-5. See the above passages just read. He advocated and encouraged murder on a whim. Luke 19:27, and what I just read. He was one of the worst hypocrites that ever lived. Matthew 5:19. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the peacemakers, for thou shalt be called the children of God. Matthew 10:34-36. Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes shall be they of his own household. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The Nazarene condemns righteousness and works against it. And see the other scriptures that have been read. Matthew 5:11. Blessed are ye which men shall revile, when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. This is blatant of the Nazarene's hatred of humanity. Hold on, I got a cough. The Nazarene preached self-mutilation, Matthew 19:12. For there are some eunuchs, which were so born from their mother's womb, and there are some eunuchs which were made eunuchs of men, and there be eunuchs which have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He that is able to receive it, let him receive it. Oh boy, cut off my testicles. A eunuch is a castrated male. In other words, a male with his balls cut off. The Catholic Church routinely castrated young choir boys in order to prevent their voices from changing, so they would always sound like little boys. I wonder why that would be. Matthew 5:29-30. And if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. Nazarene's cruelty to animals. Matthew 8:30-32. And there was a good way off from them a herd of many swine feeding. So the devils besought him, saying, If thou cast us out, suffer us to go away into the herd of swine. And he said unto them, Go. And when they were come out, they went into the herd of swine. And behold, the whole herd of swine ran violently down a steep place into the sea and perished into the waters. What a sorry son of a bitch. That concludes the list. There's a little piece down here at the bottom. And I'll read it, and then I'll play a song, and then I'll get this other thing fixed up here. No individual in history has been provided with more excuses, twisting, warping, distorting, and outright lying of what this entity taught and did is commonplace among those who are deluded, sympathetic, and or just plain stupid. Many argue that this entity never existed and or is unimportant. People who maintain these opinions are as deluded and foolish as those who believe the Nazarene was a righteous individual. Whether or not this entity physically existed is irrelevant. The effects this creature had upon humanity has permeated every aspect of society in which most of us live. There are millions and millions who worship this creature and promote him at every level relentlessly. The impact this entity has had upon humanity is horrendous. Nearly every war there has been fought for right-hand path religious purposes, millions and millions, millions have suffered psychological disorders and hang-ups, death, etc., which prevent them from living a healthy, normal life. This sorry list of crimes against humanity perpetrated because of this individual just goes on and on and on. The list is endless. It does not matter whether this entity is a myth or physically and historically existed. The entity is a reality through all of the major injustices and workings of which have held us all back for centuries and must be destroyed. Those who take a stand for personal liberty and freedom are incessantly battling Christians in the courts as they relentlessly and obsessively work to deprive every last man, and woman of their children, every last man, woman, and child of their freedom and their lives. Okay, I'm going to go back to the studio, and I'm going to play a long song while I can hopefully get this taken care of here. Where did that one go that was long? Well, here's one right here.
If you give this man a ride, sweet family, Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone. And actor out on loan. Riders on the storm.
Okay, I'm back. Actually, I didn't have any luck here. The conversion of the file to an MP3 format keeps crapping out on me at 7% for whatever reason. And so I'll probably try one more time. Maybe if I convert it to, let's see, some other format. Man, I don't think I can get a format convertible that'll work that I can upload. So MP3 is probably pretty much it. So I'm just going to go ahead and proceed, and I guess pretty much as circumstance dictates, next week will be a continuation, and that's not a problem. I have tons of information that I can convey. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and discuss more on this topic of the New Testament Jesus and how he is a Jew. Now, I have talked to a couple of Christian identity people once, and when I asked them about some of this stuff, you know, some of these things like circumcision and so on, you know, they said, well, that was our practice at the time. That you notice the word they use, our. And it's like, yeah, okay, so this is a tradition of the European peoples? Okay, well, you know, that was the case, why were these Israelites who forgot who they were, who migrated from the Mideast to Europe, didn't continue this all these practices? I mean, you know, I mean, first of all, how do you forget who you are? Second of all, you know, if these are all traditions given to you as a chosen people, you don't forget them and you don't stop practicing them, right? I mean, you know, how many times in the Bible were the Jews punished for not doing something or doing something? You know, there's always this wrath of God every time somebody's done something wrong, you know, and he comes down and smites everybody, right? So anyway, let's face it, people. Jesus was a fucking Jew, all right? This is from a website called JesusIsAJew.org. The article is Jesus is a Jew. And I'm just going to read this as it's written. Doesn't mean I agree with all of it. Just for example, it starts out with, Jesus is a real historical person born in the land of Israel during the Roman occupation. Wrong. In approximately the year 3 BC. However, at this time, his name was actually pronounced Yeshua. And that is the name used in this article. That Yeshua was born Jewish is one of the least contested truths in the Bible. The very first verse of the covenant reads, "The book of the genealogy of Messiah, Yeshua, Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham." Who were Abraham and David? Abraham was the first Hebrew. God changed his name from Abram. And in Genesis 14:13, he is called Abram the Hebrew. So we can see that Yeshua, Jesus, is descended from Abram the Hebrew. Even to this day, Jews are also called Hebrews or Hebes. I'm interjecting that. And the language of the Jews is Hebrew. Abraham and his descendants were given the unconditional covenant of the promised land and the covenant of circumcision. And by the way, the land is Genesis 17:8 and the circumcision is Genesis 17:10. Abraham is the father of the Jews. Acts 3:12-25. Isaac was his son and Jacob was his grandson. Thus Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are known as the patriarchs, the fathers of the Jews. Jacob's name was changed by God to Israel, and he had 12 sons, from whom come the 12 tribes of Israel. All of their descendants are known collectively throughout the Bible as the children of Israel. One of those 12 sons was Judah, and it is from his name that we get the word Jew. Although Yehuda, or Judah, was one of the 12 by 700 BCE because of the course. That's interesting. They use BCE here in this article, yet they claim he was an historical figure. Well, isn't that interesting? Let me light this cigarette. So anyway, by 700 BCE, because of the course of Israel's history, the word Yehuda or Jew came to mean any person descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So, for instance, Saul HaShaliach, the Apostle Paul, was of the tribe of Benjamin, yet he self-identified as a Jew. Nevertheless, according to the Bible, the Messiah must be descended from the tribe of Judah, as King David was, and descended from King David himself. That is why the Messiah is called the Son of David. Duh. Yeshua is from the tribe of Judah. His early father was descended from David, and his mother was as well. In addition, Yeshua was born King of the Jews. The King of the Jews must himself be Jewish. His aunt Elizabeth was Jewish, a descendant of Aaron, Moses' brother, and his uncle Zechariah was a Jewish priest. Yeshua was circumcised according to the Jewish law and redeemed according to Jewish law. His mother atoned according to the Jewish law. He is called the consolation of Israel and the glory of thy people of Israel. Jesus was born a Jew. Jesus lived as a Jew. Although he was born in Bethlehem, Yeshua was raised in Nazareth, which, by the way, didn't exist. Both were Jewish towns at that time, according to archaeologists and historians. Wrong. Bethlehem is just south of Jerusalem, while Nazareth is north in the Galilee section. Both of Yeshua's parents were from Nazareth, and they returned there with the child when they had done everything according to the law of the Lord and his birth required. His aunt and uncle were also Torah observant. Jews, so we can see that probably the whole family took their faith very seriously. Yeshua's parents made the 140-mile, or 225 kilometers, I guess, or meters. No, 225 meters, I don't know, whatever that is, round trip to Jerusalem every Passover in observance of Deuteronomy 16:16. And I didn't look that up to see what that was. So anyway, it had something to do with Passover. It was at the age of 12 that Yeshua stayed behind an extra 3 days to learn from the temple teachers. Although he already understood the Torah well, his attitude of listening and questioning indicates love of the Hebrew scripture and respect for the teachers. He also respected the temple itself, calling it his father's. Near the end of his life, he praised the widow for giving all she had to the temple. In his adult life, his disciples were Jews, and they called him Rabbi. Many called him Rabboni, or Rabbani. They sought him because they believed the Torah and the prophets. A Pharisee who had not yet come to faith in him also addressed Yeshua as Rabbi, as did, just lost my spot. In adult life, his disciples were Jesus running. They came to him, rise of a crowd of people. A Pharisee who had not yet come to him in faith also addressed Yeshua as Rabbi, as did a crowd of people. A Samaritan woman easily recognized he was a Jew. And there's Bible passages to support every bit of this. I'm just not reading them. I mean, you know, it just gets ridiculously nuts to sit here and read every one of these verses out to you. You can read the damn book yourself. Yeshua's disciples spoke Hebrew, and so did he, as well as Chaldean, a closely related language brought back by the Jews from their captivity in Babylon. In the Sermon on the Mount, he affirmed the authority of the Torah and the prophets, even in the kingdom of heaven. He regularly attended synagogue, and his teachings was respected by the other congregants. He taught in the Jewish temple, and if he were not a Jew, his going into that part of the temple would not have been allowed. Although he differed with some of his contemporaries on how to keep the commandments, he did not disagree on whether to keep them, saying such things as, "If you wish to enter into life, keep the commandments." When he had healed someone of leprosy, he instructed him to show yourself to the priest and present the offering that Moses commanded. Yeshua not only taught others how to live a Jewish life, he lived it himself. Boy, did we just discover that, didn't we? The outward signs of this were such things as wearing, tassels, T-Z-I-T-Z-I-T, zit, on his clothing. And there's even a reference in Strong's Concordance on that. He wore tassels on his clothing to serve as a reminder of the commandments. He observed Passover and went up to Jerusalem. He observed Sukkot and went up to Jerusalem. He also observed Hanukkah and probably Rosh Hashanah, going up to Jerusalem on both these occasions as well, even though it isn't commanded in the Torah. The inward sign of his Judaism was a circumcised heart. When faced with temptation, Yeshua answered from the Hebrew Scripture. When teaching, he taught from the Hebrew Scripture. When admonishing, he quoted from the Hebrew Scripture. Yeshua self-identified as a Jew and as King of the Jews. From his birth to his last Passover, Seder, Jesus lived as a Jew. Jesus died a Jew. When Yeshua was taken prisoner by a Roman captain, his cohort, and some Jewish officials, and by the way, it looks like we're going to run over the time allotted, and I'm going to continue on. And if I can get that other video up, I will, but I don't think that's going to happen. But I'll definitely go over. I'll be playing a song after I finish this, but I may or may not finish. Well, I might finish before 9 o'clock. No, I'm sorry, at the top of the hour. It's 9 o'clock my time. When Yeshua was taken prisoner by a Roman captain, his cohort, and some Jewish officials, he was delivered into the custody of Jewish priests, elders, and scribes. The Roman soldiers would not have placed him under Jewish jurisdiction if he were not Jewish. Later, Yeshua was brought before the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council. He was charged with an offense against Jewish law. Pilate, head of the Roman occupation, also recognized Jewish jurisdiction over Yeshua. This was because Yeshua was a Jew. He unequivocally identified himself as the Messiah, and as we have seen above, the Messiah must be Jewish. He said he is the King of the Jews, and, as we have also seen above, the King of the Jews must himself be Jewish. The Jewish crowd also called him King of the Jews. He was mocked, spat on, and beaten by the Roman soldiers as King of the Jews. And when they crucified him, their charge was King of the Jews. I need to cough. Oops, don't think I got that one muted. The place of judgment had a Hebrew place name, and the place of crucifixion had a Hebrew place name. Joseph of Arimathea who took custody of Yeshua's body was Jewish, and he laid the body in his own new tomb. Therefore, Yeshua was buried in a Jewish cemetery. He was also buried according to the Jewish custom of the time. Without doubt, Jesus died a Jew. Jesus was a resurrected Jew. Yeshua, the risen Jew, told his Jewish disciples to go out and teach all the Gentiles. Then, after eating, talking, and walking with his disciples, Yeshua lifted up his hands and blessed them. I just noticed something here. That sentence I just read says, Yeshua, the risen Jew, told his Jewish disciples to go out and teach all of the Gentiles. And that's Matthew 28:19. Now, there's also that statement that he comes only for the lost tribes of Israel. So, well, maybe he came for them, but he was to teach, but he taught the Gentiles, or go out and teach the Gentiles. Or they told his disciples to go out and teach the Gentiles. Nevertheless, you know, if he comes for the lost tribes of Israel, but tells his disciples to go teach to the Gentiles, what the fuck, right? Then after eating, talking, and walking his disciples, Yeshua lifted up his hands and blessed them. What blessing is spoken with lifted hands? The Aaronic benediction is given in synagogues and in churches even to our day, and in the synagogues. It is still given as it was more than 1,000 years before the resurrected Jesus gave it, with lifted hands. In fact, another name for the Aaronic benediction is the lifting up of hands. Rav Shaul, or the Apostle Paul, Rav Shaul, tells us that while he was on the road to Damascus, Yeshua spoke to him from heaven in Hebrew. Shaul, a Jew who was born a Roman citizen, was fluent in Greek and possibly many other languages, but Yeshua spoke to him in Hebrew, the language of the Jews. Shaul did not become a believer until well after Yeshua's death and resurrection. Yet an important part of his message is that Yeshua is a descendant of the Jewish King David. Many years after his resurrection, Yeshua testified he is the root and offspring of King David, and in a time yet future, two of his titles will be Lion of the Tribe of Judah and Root of David. In Matthew 24:20, he told us to pray concerning the coming tribulation, that we would not have to flee on the Sabbath. And in Matthew, Yeshua told his disciples that he will celebrate the Passover Seder anew with us in his Father's kingdom. The standard he will use at the judgment is the law God gave the Jews. To those who do not do the will of God, he will say, "Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness." And we are told Yeshua, the Messiah, is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So, if he ever was a Jew, he was resurrected a Jew, and he is one to this day. He was born a Jew, he lived a Jew, he died a Jew, and he was resurrected a Jew. He is alive and Jewish now and forevermore the same. End of article. All right, well, I'm going to play a song and I'll continue on. So, archives, if you can still hear this live. All right. Okay, I'm back. That was ZZ Top, Waiting on a Bus, and Jesus Just Left Chicago. All right, well, what I've decided while that song was playing is that I'm just going to continue with the show as planned, see how far I get, and I will say this, that I want to play that other video next week for sure, as long as I can get the damn thing converted. And I could have done it had everything cooperated. Software just wouldn't cooperate. But I'm also going to find the webpage here amongst these websites that I go to regularly that will show how most of, if not all of the stories in the Old Testament were just total ripoffs. They just stole everything. And I'll demonstrate what I'm talking about and where it came from. So, I've got another little short article here called Jesus the Jewish Archetype. Kind of relates to what I just read, but in fact it was sourced from it. So I'll kind of just skip through it real quick, and then we'll go to the next article I have lined up. There are a small number of deluded Gentile fools who try to claim the Nazarene was a Gentile. Well, the following biblical scriptures prove beyond any doubt that the Jewishness of the Nazarene and his relation to the Gentiles. As for the Jewishness of his teachings, refer to Christianity and communism, Jewish twins. Now, Lou read that article on one of his shows. I would suggest finding that one and listening to it. The Nazarene is a fictitious Jewish invented archetype for Gentiles to slavishly worship. This character is based upon some 18 crucified pagan gods stolen and corrupted from Gentile pantheons. For more information proving the Nazarene character is fictitious, then there's other links that can be gone to from this webpage. And by the way, if you go to my bio page, you will see the source of all of this information there. Then you'll have to just do your own searching from there. The Jews themselves know the Nazarene is a lie. And as mentioned before, the book of the generations of Jesus says he was son of David of Abraham. Well, again, who was Abraham? Circumcision was not a popular practice among Gentiles. Male circumcision in the Renaissance. Let me read this. Europeans, with the exceptions of the Jews, did not practice male circumcision. In 1753 in London, there was a proposal for Jewish emancipation. It was furiously opposed by the pamphleteers of the time, who spread the fear that Jewish emancipation meant universal circumcision. Wow, you think they knew something? Men were urged to protect the best of your property and guard their threatened foreskins, a striking indication of how central to their sexual identity men considered their foreskins at the time. Until well into the 19th century, the same sentiments prevailed. Richard Burton observed that Christendom practically holds circumcision in horror. This attitude is reflected in the 9th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, dated 1876, which discusses the practice as a religious rite among Jews, Muslims, the ancient Egyptians, and tribal peoples in various parts of the world. The author of the entry rejected sanitary explanations of the procedure in favor of a religious one. Like other bodily mutilations, it is of the nature of a representative sacrifice. So, have you been forced to sacrifice your foreskin of your penis? All right, and then it gives the generations again. According to rabbinical law and in the tradition of male Jews, a Nazarene was circumcised and named on the eighth day in the temple. Jewish term for synagogue that's a Jewish term for synagogue. Anyway, let me read that part of it. The Nazarene was circumcised and named on the eighth day in the temple by a rabbi. And that's Luke 2:21. And when 8 days were accomplished for the circumcising of the child, his name was called Jesus, which was so named of the angel before he was conceived in the womb. Jesus' Mary's mother was also observant of Orthodox Jewish law, where a woman is unclean following her menstrual period or childbirth. Modern Orthodox Jews still follow these laws. The following scriptures are rather blatant regarding the Jewish identity of the Nazarene and his relation to non-Jews or Gentiles. Luke 2:25, Luke 2:26, Luke 2:27, 28, 29, 30, and 31. Let's see if I should read this or not. Yeah, let me read it. And behold, there was a man in Jerusalem whose name was Simeon. And the same man was just and devout, waiting for the consolation of Israel. And the Holy Ghost was upon him. Ooh. And it was revealed unto him by the Holy Ghost that he should not see death before he had seen the Lord's Christ. And he came by the Spirit into the temple. And came by the Spirit. Okay. And when the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him after the custom of the law, then took he him up in his arms and blessed God and said, Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace according to thy word, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation, which thou hast prepared before the face of all people, a light to lighten the Gentiles, and the glory of the people Israel. Now, why would they make that distinction there? Note in the above, verse 32, the distinction between Gentiles and Israel. Okay, I noticed it, and then it was right here in the article. Both of the Nazarene's parents were observant Jews who made the yearly pilgrimage for the Feast of Passover. Luke 2:41, now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the Feast of Passover. The Nazarene was very clear in his attitudes towards the Gentiles and the distinction between Jew and Gentile. Matthew 20:25, but Jesus called unto him and said, ye know that the prince of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and that they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall be so among you, but whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. Again, he was called rabbi. And a Jew by Gentiles. He regularly attended and taught in the Jewish synagogue and observed the Jewish Sabbath. Only the Jews were allowed in the temple. Let's see here. Acts 21 through 28. I'm not going to read it, but it says this little note right below it. Note the above scriptures do not pertain to the Nazarene, but to Paul. The Nazarene was long gone at this time, according to scripture, though Paul was a Jew. His mission was to the Gentiles. Well, maybe I should read it. Only Jews were allowed in the temple. Gentiles were and are to this day considered unclean by both conservative and Orthodox Jews. Acts 21 through 28. I'm sorry, Acts 21, verse 25 through 28. As touching the Gentiles which believe, we have written and concluded that they observe no such thing, save only that they keep themselves from things offered to idols, and from blood, and from strangled, and from fornication. Then Paul took the men, and the next day, purifying himself with them, entered into the temple to signify the accomplishment of the days of purification, until that of an offering should be offered for every man of them. And when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews which were of Asia, when they saw him in the temple, stirred up all the people and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man that teaches all men everywhere against the people and the law in this place, and further brought Greeks also into the temple, and hath polluted his holy place." Again, note that that pertained to Paul, not the Nazarene. Like his parents, he observed the Passover. He also observed Hanukkah. He quoted Hebrew scriptures. Let's see here. There's something interesting out of part of this that I want to read. Right. Maybe I need to read all of it. He quoted Hebrew scriptures, and you'll see why I read it after the end. Matthew 4:1. Then was Jesus led up of the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he was afterward and hungered. And when the tempter came to him, he said, "If thou be the Son of God, command that these stones be made bread." But he answered and said, "It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. And the devil taketh him up unto the holy city, and setteth him on a pinnacle of the temple, and saith unto him, If thou be the Son of God, cast thyself down, for it is written, He shall give his angels charge concerning thee, and in their hands they shall bear thee up, lest at any time thou dash thy foot against a stone. Jesus said unto him, It is written again, Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God." It's interesting. In the Talmud, it also says, "Thou shalt not tempt the devil." Okay. Again, the devil taketh him up unto an exceeding high mountain, and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them, and saith unto him, "All these things I will give thee, if thou wilt fall down and worship me." Then saith Jesus unto him, "Get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve." Then the devil leaveth him, and behold, angels came and ministered unto him. Deuteronomy 8:3. And he humbled thee, and suffered thee to hunger, and fed thee with the manna, which thou knewest not, neither did thy fathers know, that he might take thee now, that man doth not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of the Lord doth man live. Deuteronomy 6:16. Ye shall not tempt the Lord thy God as ye tempted him in Massa. Deuteronomy 6:13. Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God and serve him, and shalt swear by his name. Now note in what I just read above, all of this being fictitious, of course, Satan approached the Nazarene not as an equal, but as a superior. An equal does not worship an equal. He readily admitted to his Jewish identity, and Pilate asked him, "Art thou king of the Jews?" And he answered, and he answering said unto them, "Thou sayest it." Many deluded Gentiles claim the Nazarene was murdered by the Jews, thus he must be a Gentile. This is utter nonsense, as the scripture proves otherwise. The Jews only punish their own for breaking Jewish law, as only one born of a Jewish mother can be a Jew and held accountable to Jewish law. Matthew 26:64. Jesus saith unto him, Thou hast said, Nevertheless I say unto you, Hereafter shall ye see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power, and coming in the hands of, and coming in the clouds of heaven. And the next verse, then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, He hath spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? Behold, now ye we have heard his blasphemy. Next verse, What think ye? They answered and said, He is guilty of death. And John, the Jews answered him, We have a law, and by our law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God. Then said Pilate unto them, Take ye him, and judge him according to your law. The Jews therefore said unto him, It is not lawful for us to put any man to death. Pilate answered, Am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done? Duh! He was buried a Jew. Okay, there's references. So anyway, the problem is most people believe what they're told. In order to expose Christianity, one must delve deeply into forbidden knowledge. When one begins intense research into the occult, occasionally one will meet with frightening experiences. Well, this is simply because of the mind or spiritual power that has been put into protecting this knowledge for centuries and keeping it forbidden. You know, Orthodox Jews at the higher levels and their Gentile lackeys as well, such as the ultra-corrupt Vatican of the Church, which is and always has been their tool to control the Gentiles, have known about and used this power for centuries. One must continue on relentlessly, and there comes a point where the real truth will be assessed and the powers the enemy has used are no longer effective. Anyway, I need a cough here. Hold on just one sec. Okay. Let me go ahead and close that window. And what I've got next here is the ubiquitous Nazarene. But what I'm going to do here, I want to take a drink and go to the restroom. I'm going to go ahead and go back to the studio here and play one more song. Let's see here what I've got on here. I'm going to play this one for right now.
You really don't want me. just keep me hanging on. You really don't need me. You just keep me hanging on. Why do you keep coming around, playing with my heart? Why don't you get out of my life and help me to make a new start?
Just keep me hanging on.
Okay, I'm back. The next piece that I'm going to cover here is entitled The Ubiquitous Nazarene, and we'll pretty much go through how the Nazarene can be used no matter what the time, no matter what the place, no matter what the culture, no matter what the circumstances. Hold on just one sec, I got a call. Okay. Now, all right, here we go. The Ubiquitous Nazarene. The Nazarene is made up of nothing but stolen legends, stolen identities, and a bunch of meaningless, worthless, hypocritical, and contradictory teachings. I don't think there has been a character in all of history that is as fictitious as the Nazarene idiot. And because he is a lie, he can change according to the times. He was invented to be nothing more than a distraction for the masses with the intention of removing all spiritual knowledge and power from the populace and placing it in the hands of a controlling few to the detriment of all. Christianity has survived because it has always adapted to the times, just as it is doing now. Oh, excuse me, that would snuck up on me. The Christian church finally admitted insidiously that the earth is not flat. If they hadn't, they wouldn't have never survived. That is just one of numerous examples. Now, the Nazarene has put on a new age face. New age face. The teachings of the original gods and the ancient knowledge are all of a sudden attributed to the Nazarene. This is whether they came from Egypt. This is whether they came from Egypt. Some double-digit IQ individuals had the stupidity to claim he was a pharaoh. Anyway, in the 1960s and 70s, he was the ideal hippie. Now he is the great teacher of this new age crap in the threefold joke, which of course includes those nefarious angels in Judeo-Christian mysticism. During the Crusades, he was the Christian warrior leading the Christian armies to slaughter everyone in their path. Onward, Christian soldiers. With Islam, he still exists, but this time not as the Son of God, but as a prophet. He seems to be everywhere and conforms to every trend in every culture. Just slap the ragged, poor, professional victim on two crossed sticks of wood, and there he is. The only thing that is real concerning this ubiquitous clown is the suicidal teachings designed to turn the whole of society into malleable slaves. The underlying message never changes. This is analogous to the harmless-looking rodent that brings in lethal parasites that infest the locale, like what happened with the bubonic plague of the Middle Ages. Because he is fictitious, he can be made into whatever they please, as long as it is done insidiously. He can be anything at any time and anywhere. On one hand, he is celibate and the Son of God. On the other hand, in order to adapt with the sexual openness of today, he now has sexual relations with Mary Magdalene. Because new knowledge has come from the Far East, of course, he was there from age 13 to 30, and there is no written record, so they can make up anything they wish. This way, they can attribute a lot of Eastern teachings to him and claim the all is one crap. Yeah, the all is one until someone mentions Satan, and either they're in denial or defensiveness out of these jokers. Okay, I'm going to reread that. Yeah, the all is one until someone mentions Satan, and either there is denial or defensiveness out of these jokers. Because homosexuality is becoming more open, now parts of the Gospel of St. John, which were conveniently deleted, claim he had sexual intercourse with another male. He can be anything at any time and anywhere. The Nazarene never gives any direct answers to anything. This way, any Bible thumper is free to quote here and there as they see fit. His parables fit any situation at any time and say nothing. They can be interpreted 100 different ways. Just put him on a stick and start pounding away. Okay, my cord has gotten tangled here. Give me just 1 second to fix the situation. Hold on. Okay, what I have to do is unplug this thing from the computer next time I reboot it and get this cord untangled. I just don't like doing it while the computer is going because it when I plug it in, it thinks it's a new device and wants to add another one in there. So anyway, the next thing I have here, and I don't know whether I'm going to get through it or not. We'll see. It's going to be pretty close. If I don't, I'll finish at the beginning of the next show. It's called The Christian Mass and How It Ties into Jewish Ritual Murder. Due to centuries of the vehement suppression of spiritual knowledge, most people are not only unaware of, but also they are unable to see certain truths. This is the enemy's way of conquering by creating a blind spot in the soul where one is spiritually disarmed. The so-called sixth sense is lacking in most people, and in many others, it is completely absent. Millions of unfortunate people are and have been deceived by the Christian-Muslim programs, both of these whose sole intention is to destroy spiritual knowledge and replace it with lies for the destruction of humanity and every other living creature on this earth. The Judeo-Christian Bible warns its believers regarding the powers of the mind and of witchcraft so that no one is able to see through the blatant lies that are right there every day. The Jews, who are parasites by nature, have always used Gentiles as their spiritual host to feed from, no different from the alien greys who use their collection of souls to feed from. Many of you are already familiar with the Jewish ritual murder. During the times of Jewish holidays, top rabbis will abduct Gentile children and use them in their ritual sacrifices to Jehovah. The child is taken to a secret back room of a synagogue, tied to a cross, and then tortured to death with the blood drained from the four corners, meaning hands and feet, while the child is still alive and aware, and then his blood is drunk ritually by the rabbis. This heinous act has been performed repeatedly for centuries, and this is why the Jews have endured endless pogroms, parentheses, where Gentiles have massacred entire villages of Jews, close parentheses. Endured endless pogroms, have been forcibly expelled from nearly every country of the world except for the USA. I'll add something to that in a second. And have been hated to an extreme by every Gentile race. This is just one. I could go on and on endlessly of the crimes that the Jews have committed ad nauseum, but the purpose of this sermon meaning preaching to people like us and me, is how all of this ties into the Christian mass church service. For more about this practice, see this other article called 2,000 Years of Jewish Ritual Murder. Now, what I was going to add here is that there was one expulsion in the U.S. during the War of Northern Aggression where General Grant issued an order restricting Jews from certain areas because of their the way they are by going in and plundering and basically causing havoc for everybody. I guess it was, in hindsight of saying that, I guess it was better that the Union Army did it instead of the Jews. Maybe he was protecting the Jews. Anyway, Lincoln had it rescinded. There was a title of a book I noted on a shelf in the public library written by a Jewish rabbi, and the title was Thou Shalt Prosper. This is also in the Bible. This title was in reference to the Jews. Nearly everyone is aware of the unbelievable material wealth, success, and power this race has had for centuries. This directly results from their abuse of occult power, and all of this ties directly into Christianity. As I mentioned many times before, the Judeo-Christian book is a book of Jewish witchcraft, the verses, their numbers, and so forth. In order to know this, one must know how witchcraft, words of power, and most of all, the subliminal and the powers of the mind work to bring the operator's intention to manifest in reality. And with so much of the Jewish workings, the subliminal is used to make the necessary subconscious connection to establish an energy link. One must know about witchcraft and the powers of the mind to know this. This is why the Bible warns and works to frighten Gentiles away from anything really spiritual. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, and other crap about burning in a lake of fire, etc. In addition, I noted early on that there were curses involved in one using one's powers of the mind to prevent this and to frighten those who scare easily away from this sort of thing. Cough. Eat me, drink me. The entire theme of the Christian Mass Church service is that of a simulation of a human sacrifice. Most people cannot see this, nor are they aware of it due to their minds being walled up. The Nazarene, with every Mass or service, is crucified in a blood sacrifice to Jehovah. I remember very well the endless repeated phrases used by the priests so that a connection is established. This is the body of Christ, and then that stupid little communion wafer where the believer eats that body of Christ. Now we know the Nazarene was nailed to that cross, the four corners, no different from the Gentile children that the Jews use in their sacrifices. This creates the necessary connection that fuels the energies for the Jewish ritual murders, bringing success to the Jewish race, especially that of the vast material wealth. In each and every Catholic Mass, for one, and with Protestants, the theme is the same. These same verses are drummed into the minds of the congregation over and over and over again, over again. On the night he was betrayed, he took bread and gave you thanks and praise. He broke the bread, gave it to his disciples, and said, "Take this, all of you, and eat it. This is my body, which will be given up for you." When supper was ended, he took the cup. Again, he gave you thanks and praise, gave the cup to his disciples, and said, "Take this, all of you, and drink from it. This is the cup of my blood." See the connection? This is blatantly a human sacrifice. Let me light this cigarette. People cannot see this because they have been spiritually blinded. I can see all kinds of things as I have knocked down the walls of my mind and remember just four of weeks ago when hearing religious Christmas songs blasting over the speakers in the store I was in. It was very blatant to me how these deluded Christian fools were singing for their damnation. Well, that didn't stay lit. Hold on. To create the necessary distraction and to confuse their victims, the Jews have always pretended to be persecuted by Christians. They pretend to be at odds with Christianity. If one's walls are knocked down, one can see what is there right in front of us every day. The entire Bible has either the word Jew, Jews, Israel, and related written on every page, and with all of those, the Jewish people and their patriarchs are honored and exalted. And by the way, the word blood appears more than any other word in the book. The Bible follows a subliminal theme in that Gentiles are conquered repeatedly in the Old Testament by the Jews and their God Jehovah. When I say the whole book, that doesn't mean etc. After all of this conquering and enslaving, the Nazarene, the long-awaited Jewish Messiah, comes on the scene. Jewish from birth to death. And then it references an article here, probably one of the ones I just read. The Jewish Nazarene character was invented from a concept, that of the serpentine witch power. And there's a reference to an article here. I may read that at some point. Probably. And for a working to succeed in many cases. Those of you who don't know what I'm saying by a working. A working is a ritual or a magical act. Again, for a working to succeed in many cases, there must be some sort of connection in the mind of the victim. Most Christians cannot see that Jehovah was a murderer and a liar from the beginning. The New Testament goes on with the Nazarene then becoming a human sacrifice, murdered and sacrificed to Jehovah, the murderous, bloodthirsty, and sadistic father. In its own twisted way, this translates into the murder of children, because the mind of a child is in many cases a blank slate in the way of limited personal experiences that shape attitudes and color the personality. Children are prime victims. Christianity is notorious for preying upon children as our angels and, of course, filthy kikes. They know they can use the energy of children quite freely as there is little or no spiritual resistance. And by the way, every time you summon an angel, a gray shows up. Angels are evil. And if you read the Bible, every time you hear or read about an angel, death and destruction that's soon to follow. Then the final cap with all of this is the second coming of Christ, which is in truth another hoax designed to channel Gentile spiritual energies and beliefs through the mass mind into making the coming of the Jewish Messiah into a reality. And by the way, why the hell would he need to come twice? Wasn't once enough? You know, I mean, you know, what is the whole, you know, deal about that, right? I mean, okay, yeah, you want to argue, okay, well, you know, he's got to come, he's got to teach, and everybody's got to make a decision whether they accept or not. Yeah, well, that, you know, that's just real convenient now, isn't it, okay? Anyway, quote from the Jewish Talmud, Simeon had Darson, when the Messiah comes, every Jew will have 2,800 slaves, and I read that earlier. Most people are totally unaware of the above and cannot see this. I already wrote in another sermon concerning how the Jews use occult power, and it references a link. Let's see here. It gives an excerpt from it. There's still a couple of minutes here. I could read this. The video below, which I highly recommend everyone seeing, and I'm going to find out what it is exactly, is nothing new and blatantly exposes the Jews and how they abuse occult power. The power of suggestion in the subliminal to make the subconscious connection to manifest their workings in reality. The shootings were for the purpose of instituting gun control. Many people, such as the author of the video linked below, have no idea of the Jewish power, feeding off of and directing the energy that the deluded followers of the Christian program provide for their Jewish masters. It is behind all of this and can only make misguided guesses. It has reference to Sandy Hook and the Batman shootings. Let me light this again. Okay, maybe it will stay lit this time. The Jewish abuse of occult powers has its roots in their gematria. The 9/11 was another one, very blatant. A co-worker some years ago showed me how a $20 bill could be folded a certain way so that on the rear of it, the Twin Towers going up in smoke would appear. Look on the internet for this. I don't have the time to search out the websites that have this. All of a sudden, after the 9/11 incident, the older version of the $20 bills, which you could find, which you could fold it in that way, was taken out of circulation. They fed the public the bullshit story that they were too easy to counterfeit. Well, they disappeared real fast, as too many people knew the deal on how to fold them. The 20 is the most common currency used and circulated in the U.S., Others include presidential assassinations. I did some research on this a few years back. Note about Lincoln and the names, dates, and the numbers and how they all come together in a very creepy way, including the use of their version of witchcraft. 9/11 is another blatant one. The date, the flights, the numbers, such as New York City, 11 letters. Just do your own research on this. In closing, the suicidal doctrines and teachings that poverty is a virtue and the rejection of material wealth work to ensure that the Jews prosper and that all wealth and power is in their hands. These suicidal teachings are drummed into the minds of Gentiles from a very early age, making sure they take a root hold and will even last for future lifetimes, ensuring poverty. And it's got some more quotes from the Talmud here. SCPH, God has given the Jews power over the possessions and blood of all nations. Skulshan Aruch, chosen Hamak. All property of other nations belongs to the Jewish nation, which consequently is entitled to seize upon it without any scruples. Same book. When a Jew has a Gentile in his clutches, another Jew may go to the same Gentile, lend him money, and in turn deceive him, so that the Gentile shall be ruined. For the property of a Gentile, according to our law, belongs to no one, and the first Jew that passes has full right to seize it. Behind it all, the Jews are the ones who push Christianity, though they try to deceive the world into believing otherwise. I see this all the time, as I am very aware of it. Even with small unimportant things as crossword puzzles, books, most are authored by Jewish writers, and there are endless references to Christianity in that filthy Bible. Like everyone is supposed to know those filthy Jewish characters and archetypes by rote. Like this is supposed to be common everyday accepted knowledge. Okay, let me get to my closing thoughts. We'll get a song out here. And whether or not the song makes it for the end of the show complete, I don't know. So again, what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? Truth is not fear investigation. The truth is hate only to those who hate the truth. A noble society is not ruled by might, but by law. Preserving your culture isn't hate. It's about survival. You do not have the right to never be offended. The fact that they want our guns is all the more reason to have them. There are no illegal guns, only illegal gun laws. Anti-gun is anti-white. Anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. Free men aren't equal, and equal men aren't free. Distinct peoples have a right to remain distinct. Multiracialism is not self-government. Forced association isn't freedom. If you worship your enemy, you are defeated. If you adopt your enemy's religion, you are enslaved. If you breed with your enemy, you are destroyed. Ridicule is the only weapon which can be used against unintelligible propositions. There is no higher religion than truth. Racial death is forever. 1488. So until next time, hail Satan. And we'll go out here with some Moody Blues.
In white satin, never reaching the end. Letters I've written, never meaning to send. Beauty I'd always with these eyes before. Just what the truth, I can't say anymore, 'cause I love you. Defend just what you